from Blend University.
Okay, so thanks so much to Keith for saving me from the Swedish winter and allowing me this opportunity to join this really inspiring conference. So when I went through my presentation yesterday, I sort of realized that it wasn't close to 50 minutes, it was closer to 35 minutes. So I had to do some last minute amputation. Therefore, I will not focus so much on the partition plan for Palestine as I do in my paper, but rather focus on the genealogy of Article 18 in the UDHR. So my presentation will sort of overlap a bit with what Glenn and Pam were speaking about earlier. But a little bit of background. My interest in the 20th century history of religious liberty really began in 2008, 2009, while I was working in the Department for Human Rights and International Law at the Swedish Ministry of Foreign Affairs. So in my work, I was following the very hostile and unproductive debates on religion and human rights in the Human Rights Council and the Third Committee of the General Assembly. And what more, I was really bothered by following the internal EU discussions on these issues and the unwillingness of European diplomats to engage in any serious discussions on what religious liberty really means. So whenever someone like me raised a critical question, the standard reply was that, well, you know, Article 18 says so and so, as if the drafters of the Universal Declaration had somehow come up with this timeless articulation of religious liberty in this golden moment of 1948. So I really came into this field of human rights history with the particular aim of wanting to denaturalize, to historicize Article 18, to uncover the political struggles that underpin this specific expression of religious liberty during the late 1940s. So in this work, I've been extremely inspired by some of the new historians of human rights that have been mentioned, including the works of Samuel Moyn, Mark Mazower, Hans Joas, and Glenda Sluga, and so on. But I've also found that when trying to apply some of these counter-narratives of the emergence of international human rights to my specific case, I've realized that they at best explain some parts of the story of how the UDHR's expression of religious liberty came about. Thus, what I will try to show in the rest of my talk is that if we focus on the genealogy of a very specific articulation of a very specific human rights principle, instead of considering the emergence of human rights as an abstract political concept, we get a very different picture. So, in his 2004 article, The Strange Triumph of Human Rights, Mark Mazower famously suggested that human rights in the 1940s functioned as a smoke screen behind which the corpse of the legal nation's minorities policy could be safely buried. And as I see it, this general shift between minority rights to human rights was also accompanied by a change in the shape of religious liberty. In the treaty between the Allied powers and Poland of 1919, a treaty that really served as the blueprint for the entire interwar system, religious liberty had been primarily defined as the positive rights of members of minority populations to establish religious institutions of various kinds, to use their own language, and to follow religious commandments. And the two concluding articles of the Polish treaty also spelled out the rights of Jews, the rights of Polish Jews to observe the Shabbat and to independently organize the distribution of public funds to Jewish schools. And for all the political aversion that minority rights triggered in the 1940s, some of these components were actually transplanted into the first draft of the Universal Declaration, into Article 46, which you'll have here. After much negotiation, this article was eventually omitted from the final text, which is now completely silent on the rights of minorities. As I see it, this was partly due to the interventions of some of the most prolific figures in the Human Rights Commission. In a reflection of his commitment to French Republican ideals after the war, René Cassin argued that minority rights and individual rights were in fact incompatible concepts. And he warned that if this article would be realized, there would be a, quote, danger of cutting off certain communities and thereby working against the community of nations, unquote. And in this regard, he joined forces with Eleanor Roosevelt, who insisted that minorities, quote, did not exist as such in the United States, unquote, and that her government instead practiced a policy of cultural assimilation. And although they were not particularly interested in the faith of religious minorities, religious liberty as such, their interventions really caused the burial of this article, and it meant that the UDHR, as I mentioned, completely disregarded the rights of minorities. But it also meant that the document abandoned the institutional aspects of religious liberty that had been at the very heart of the minority rights treaties. And a further consequence of this abandoning of minority rights is that the final version of the UDHR only devotes one article to religious liberty, and that is Article 18. But in order to understand this article, however, we must move beyond Mazow's thesis and include other political forces at work during the late 1940s. And inspired by Samuel Moyn's 2010 essay, Personalism, Community, and the Origins of Human Rights, which is published in Stefan Ludwig Hoffmann's anthology, I read the emphasis in Article 18 on the inner dimensions of conscience and thought and conscience and religion as a clear reflection of the Christian personalist conceptions of human rights that were highly influential in the post-war human rights discourse. Personalisms, in their various forms, all presented themselves as a third way between liberalism and communism. And against these delusions of the modern age, personalism offered a return to classical humanistic ideals, and most often to religion. So the most famous representative of this school of thought was arguably the Catholic philosopher Jacques Maritain. But in the Human Rights Commission, this position was most strongly represented by Charles Malik, the Lebanese ambassador, who insisted that the inner freedom of conscience was really the core value of human rights in general and religious liberty in particular. Quote, the human person's most sacred and inviolable possessions are his mind and his conscience, enabling him to perceive the truth, to choose freely, and to exist, unquote.